you let that image from the poem soak, those who were here before, that for poetry makes nothing happen, it survives in the valley of its making where executives would never want to tamper, flows on south from ranches of isolation and the busy griefs, raw towns that we believe and die in. It survives a way of happening, a mouth. Just let it simmer in the, yeah. Let that image, that sustained image, you know, simmer in your tissues for a while. It's super. Of course, that poem is filled with many of them. But. Well, let's look at Stafford first. We're in sort of a race against time tonight. Have you all read it? Mm-hmm. You want to respond to it right now?
I love it.
Good. Okay, why? Why?
Because it inspired me. I mean, I started spinning words.
Work?
You know, he talks spinning words out on the page. Doesn't, to me, to think, you know, I'm going to really write something is awesome, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Got to know what I'm going to say before I write it and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But just to sit down and just whatever comes, write down. It doesn't matter if it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It doesn't have to.
Okay,
that's
you...
exciting.
Okay, are you... In, have you been doing that the last couple of days?
Yeah.
Or something? Has other things that he said started to happen?
That's the one thing I've been thinking about. You know, one thing about, you know, the skill, he talks about skill.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, he doesn't understand that. He thinks that everyone probably has the skill of a writer at age 3 or 4. It's just
yeah.
that the writer has been practicing.
And doing more and
yeah,
more.
Yeah, and then he tries. Remember the one thing about trusting himself to the grace or to the luck
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or to
yeah.
the skill or whatever you want to call it.
Sounds like a darn good sermon, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. The guy is a sort of Quaker fellow, and that's the gospel just does leap out of this thing in certain places. It really does. But by the way, his first book came out when he was 50 years old,
mm-hmm.
and then he was 55, I think, and then his first book was West of Your City, and not much happened to it. Then he gave the poems in that book plus a number of other poems to someone else to put a collection together of his best stuff. He wasn't a very good judge of his own stuff all the time. And then someone else put the book together and it won the National Book Award the next year. Huh?
Is that called The Rescue Year?
No, that was his third book. His first big book was the National Book Award one, was Traveling Through the Dark. And we have, I think, copies up in our store. And it is a beaut. And then the next one, Rescued Year, is another one, fine one. And Allegiance is another fine one. Then the book that followed that was called Someday Maybe, and I was let down. I don't know much about that, but the first, those three, Traveling Through the Dark, Rescued Year, and Allegiances, were so exciting to me that's actually one of the reasons I didn't enjoy the fourth book, Someday Maybe, so much, because I was expecting so much. You know, I was expecting so much. And I did feel let down on the fourth, but anyway, those first ones were super.
I like what he says about later others and maybe myself will make judgments. And then he says, now I am headlong to discover.
Yeah.
I like that phrase.
Yeah, headlong to discover. And that's Charles Williams. Charles Williams says creativity is that's what creativity is, discovery. We get confused sometimes when we think we're, you know, creative writer, and what I have to do then is to fabricate something, and it's, we discover. We don't create in the sense that, in a very real sense, we do discover things. Ah, it's headlong to discover. Okay.
Careless of Failure.
Mm-hmm. I like that one, Careless of Failure. Yeah. I'm always very careful of failure.
Carol Hinderly has a line, you know, courage of imperfection, something that the gospel gives us, the courage of imperfection. And that's what much of this is about, isn't it? Other responses? Just off the top. He does say that, you know, it could be offensive, what he's writing, could be offensive to some. And so, is anyone offended? Should I ask that.
Josh, thank you.
Huh?
The line that can one inclusion is important to displaying receptivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've been paying attention to several different things that I've been reading.
Yeah.
That whole receptivity being such an act necessary.
It's one of the major themes in our calling, and of course forgiveness of sins is what our calling is about. So it's a well timed to have our calling in this at the same time. Receptivity. Simone Weil has a tremendous essay taught about receptivity and attention as being the organ that a student uses should use best, and then says that. And every time what the student does that, the devil just turns, you know, just gets furious. The organ of she talks of, we have an, since she's using a metaphor, but an organ of attention that we use in order to study, be a good student. It's an organ of attention. It's not retention, but attention, paying attention. And the phrase I used in the Vespers the other night, pray attention, you know. There is that aspect of it. While Simone Weil says that the organ that we use to pay attention is the same organ we use to pray. And I like putting them together. And that's something that is clearly here. What is the first stanza, or first stanza? You notice I have my poet shirt and my poet sweater on tonight? I'm trying. I washed my hair, took a shower. Okay, anyway, what does that first paragraph have to do with our demand for inspiration? Most people who've written it feel like must have an inspiration before I write. Teresa, you were mentioning some of that.
Well, it's to feel like you have inspiration means that you have the standard. You have mm-hmm. to have the standards that he talks about, and he doesn't have any standards.
Mm-hmm.
And
he doesn't have any standards in the writing business. Yeah.
When he's just saying, what was I going to say? What was the question?
What does it do to inspiration? And that you had mentioned about that.
You don't have to be inspired. All you have to do is accept whatever comes.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that comes is okay to accept.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be inspirational. It doesn't have to come with some force or with some power.
Yeah.
Just if it occurs to him, he writes it down.
And then he also says that a lot of what he writes is expendable. Yeah,
yeah, that's the final thing.
That's important.
It's an important thing to remember,
because
yeah.
You read an awful lot where people haven't edited their own work.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The,
close to myself, I think.
Yeah.
I just really love the process of discovering. What he's saying to me is that is the way I feel like I write. And it's really nice to know that somebody else who's considered something
feels
the
same
way.
Yeah.
I can't believe some of the things that he's saying. It's describing to me the whole poetic experience, very well.
Yeah.
And the whole process, the joy,
Joy in the process itself.
The feeling, especially when he's talking about getting up in the morning. For him, it's morning. For me, it's night.
Yeah.
just sit and then start, you know, and just know that you have the urge to write and have no idea where you're going or what you're talking about. And you know, and having the joy then that, you know, you spin out something that talks to you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's many times that I feel like I write something. And even immediately I won't understand it. Maybe in a week I could see through.
Yeah.
And it's piercing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sometimes real piercing. But just, I don't know. It's like it carries you along. You know, you're not...
Yeah. He has another essay that preceded this one. This one I think is a better... He was fishing for this essay when he wrote the other essay. And the other essay is called Writing the Australian Crawl.
Uh-huh.
Writing the Australian Crawl. That each word is like a stroke that moves you to another place. And also, once you start to swim, it's an automatic process. That you are pulling yourself through the water, you know. That the one word gets you to another place that demands this word. And then this word, and then this word. And I like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that image, too. It was not as qualified as this is. It was a lot longer than this is, too. This says everything it's the other said in
mm-hmm.
much shorter way. But that sense of that I must be inspired to write, I can't remember who, some writer, Robert Penn Warren maybe said, that inspiration is another, for a writer, inspiration is another word for laziness. Yeah. Inspiration is another word for laziness. That you, now certainly Stafford gets inspired.
Mm-hmm.
He finds something to inspire him in writing this way. He starts writing this way and pretty soon something grabs him, overtakes him, overpowers him, and he, in such a unself-conscious way that he doesn't even, I'm sure, know that he's been grabbed. He just starts developing something, some image, some idea, with an image, whatever. He says even it could be just a strange, sometimes the language, even the syllables that happen along may start a trend. We were talking about the S-poems.
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
can happen.
Yeah.
If you can write and you don't even know you're alliterating, and then everything is alliterated, you know, and then you get a little embarrassed. But you know, when you read it, it gets very messy to read those kinds of poems.
Mm-hmm.
Spitting all over everything. But but anyway, it's fun. The very simple statement in that first paragraph, that is, he does not draw on a reservoir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Makes potential writers of us all. Now he will apparently contradict that statement of not drawing on a reservoir later in the piece. But what he means there is that we don't always draw on something that we don't draw on something we already have put together in us, and then give it. I used to be told write of what you know, and that's good, but many times what I know is what you know, and therefore dull. What I already know, say, can be screamingly dull. So finding what I find out that I have to say can have an originality and an interest that what I already carry around as thinking I know just doesn't have. The great sentence in the next paragraph, the one thing would lead to another, the world would give and give. You know, sounds like a worldview shaping up here, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
A whole way of looking at the world. One thing leads to another, the world would give and give. He brings a plays on that down below, or on the next page too. Okay, the first thing that Elise brought up, the implication is the importance of receptivity. It is like fishing. It's interesting to note that the... that poets have talked of what they do as fishing for thousands and thousands of years.
Mm.
You know, there's a poem written by, handed down oral tradition, the Eskimos, goes back just ages, in a book called Primitive Song by Bowruff, Bowra, and I couldn't find it over there. But it's a poem about how the Indian poet went out and was trying for a poem and fished and tried and got a nibble and missed and then lost it. And the whole poem is about the difficulty of writing, and which isn't funny too, because among poets, so many poems are written about the difficulty of writing. When you can't, you write poems, if you can't write, you sit down and write about how you can't write, and there are thousands of poems like that. There are just thousands, especially at writing schools. It's one of the jokes. Here's another poem about not being able to write. But it is like fishing. This kind of writing is like fishing. And you don't have to wait. That saying of accepting what occurs to you. You can't keep from thinking. And then, if I put something down, that will help the next thing come. That's the Australian crawl principle, that the one word is like a stroke that moves you to another place. Something I've stressed a lot, too, is in doing this kind of writing, read it, you know. What are you going to say next? Well, read what you already said, and boom, you'll have the next word, and then the next word, and then you'll have a whole paragraph, you know, and then you'll have a word, and another word, maybe a phrase, wham, another, you know, a whole bunch of things will come together all at once, and getting it out. Well, that's the first two paragraphs is getting it out. Now what does he say?
That's about readiness.
Well, actually, this is some more of getting it out, too. But that I must be willing to fail. I mean, just be careless of failure. Courage of imperfection. He disregards standards while he's writing. That's awfully important. It's awfully important to underline quite heavily at the moment. No judgment can, at the moment, be made about value, significance, and so on. The judgments can be made. I was talking to Barb a little bit after the last session, Barb and Teresa, about how important criticism is before and after one writes. During, it's death. It's just plain death. And that is very hard, to keep criticism in its place. Mm-hmm. But it's very necessary to have it as a part of your writing. Notice, though, he does talk in terms of writing. He says a writer, and he's a person who's doing this process. Some of those things will be called poems, and if enough of them do, and you write them long enough, then people start talking about you as a poet. You know, but he's talking about writing here. He really is talking about that. He's talking about the kind of thing that can produce short stories, poems, essays, plays, laws, philosophies, religions, you know, everything. That sense of if something occurs to me, it's all right to accept it. As one justification, it occurs to me. Now, how many others have tried this kind of writing? Before you done it? Have you done some? Yeah. Have you found things that scare you ever?
Yeah.
That's me, you know, that sort of shock. Even that, the willingness to accept that, I think is very important. That's, I think, how forgiveness of sins is awfully important to anybody, any thinker or writer, because they can actually find out the all-important statement that nothing human is foreign to you. And boy, writing this way, you find out that nothing human is foreign to you. You'll come up with things that scare the liver out of you. You'll come up with things that you've managed to successfully repress for, you know, 10 years. Will be popping up. And so, you betcha, it is. This right kind of writing shatters a personage, doesn't it? A role that we have, we might want to play. We find out that we're very different from that role that we may want to play.
Do you backtrack much, you know, you're writing every day. When you're writing today, do you go back to yesterday? Sometimes.
And look at the work again?
Yeah.
That's part of the criticism. You know, at the moment you don't criticize, but then the next day, pick up that stuff and look at it again. Or a week later, sometimes you let them sit longer. Yeah, you betcha. And what you said, certain parts will come out and will be piercing, mm-hmm. you know? Okay, that's in a sense another subject than the kind of writing he's saying, but then it's great to go back, look at the work, and find out that in that page there are, say, 10 lines. Now, what do you say if you find 10 lines out of 100 that are striking? You say you're a failure? Or do you take those 10 lines and see what you can do with them? You know how hard it is to say one phrase that's really powerful? You know? Remember what we were saying the last time? Is it one phrase that you actually mean? Mm-hmm. You know, instead of, don't ask a poet, does he mean what he says? Ask a poet, don't ask a poet, or say what you mean. He means what he says. You know? And how often do we find words where someone actually means, with all their being, what they say? And even in most of our stuff, we don't. But sometimes in those pages, wham, those statements come up. I was telling the other night that the poem that I got in the American Review was one which was about 40, 50 lines long, 60 lines long. And in the final version, it was 20 lines long and completely reorganized from the way it came out on the page. And it would be neat in the workshop sometime later this year if I could find it. I saved those because it was interesting, the criteria I used to reject certain lines of the original. You know, this is about something else. This is an editorial comment. This is, and got it down to the real poem. And then I said, okay, now to create this experience and feeling in the reader, I should put this first and move this here and put that there. And reorganize it in a form that someone else can take in. In a sense, making it negotiable. But just think of how many pages, if you've written this way, how many pages of maybe even very short poems you already have written in the material that you've written already. You've got the parts that just leap from the page. Well, if they leap from the page, take them out and put them together again. You've got a poem. And by poem, I mean something negotiable. I mean it's in public language. What else? That's scaring quality. Sometimes you need to just stop and say a prayer to go on, because you won't want to. I've got some examples, but I don't want to take time. The things that I've written that just shocked me. Where in the world did that come from? Feelings about my father, you know, that I did not want to recognize. His feelings that a good son would have, you know, hope, you know, and finding this stuff just come out, it just really rough. But when it came out, that particular poem is not that good, but it freed another one that is negotiable for other people. That particular poem didn't. This is a freeing process, you know. He says, sometimes they become coherent. They lead by themselves to new connections. If I qualified this essay at all, I'd say I would emphasize the making connections more than he does. That's just because I'm always talking about connections and I can't help myself. But making connections, and that once one starts to look at the work, accept it, be free to fail, be receptive, and seek connections to what you've already written, the percentage of negotiable writings goes way up, because that is really what the human race is starved for. Connections. Meaningful connections between the object and the idea, between the idea and the object, between the thought and the experience, and so forth. Just starved for meaning. And that's one of the things that makes poems negotiable. What do you do but read the thing again, you know, out loud? That sense of alerting me to something waiting in my mind, ready for sustained attention. Love that line. All of a sudden, the words that have been coming out, you know, just pretty much, you know, flowing out, they start to get thicker, weightier, denser. The meaning starts to get deeper, and so forth. Pretty soon, then all of a sudden, it's substantial enough to
you were locked in on, you were paying attention to something that you've written that you didn't know you had in you, and then you were writing the next word and the next word and the next word, and you've got probably a negotiable thing right there. Okay. Now, those who've written this way, have you found that? Sort of like a drag, you know, this writing can sometimes be like a drag drag racer. You know, you got that scream of tires, and it's just, you know, it's just roaring, you know, and the smoke is just billowing, and it's coming, and they're spinning, yeah? And then all of a sudden, the tires get hot enough? They finally lock in, and they just, boom, the drags just take off. What causes that, you know?
I don't know what causes.
You know, but those tires just sit there and spin, and then all of a sudden, certain conditions are met, okay? The wheel spinning is over. And that sucker just flies off at 160, 70 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's like a warm-up or something like that. You know, like I found in writing, like you can stumble along for a while and then all of a sudden everything just...
Boom, just connect.
It's just like everything, you know, like you're working, you're getting things warmed up, it seems.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden everything's loose.
Yeah.
Right. But it takes a while. It seems like it. You know, the more you keep at it, the shorter the time it takes.
Yeah.
It's like it's practice.
Yeah.
That's a discipline.
Yeah, and that's what he says, too, isn't it? If, okay, some of them fail, it's practice. And lots of times that first part is going to be just, it's practice, it's warming up. It's that running, it's me trying to jog, and I'm a rotten runner. You know, just feel like I'm going to die, and then all of a sudden, I'm a runner, and away I go. That second wind takes over, and I actually am running instead of fighting it. You know, I'm unselfconsciously just running right along. You know.
It's really hard to get past that first wind.
Yeah, you betcha.
It's hard. There's so many distractions you can call back on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the most frustrating part.
Yeah. That's right. One thing to remember, and this is really good, that sense of frustration is that, you know, one thing I say, usually when you write a poem, you throw away the first stanza, you know, anyway, because that's wheel spinning. And so you might as well get started, you know, because you got to throw away the first stanza anyway. So don't wait for, you know, don't have this huge self-conscious expectancy that this line has got to be a beaut, you know, and you write out some dumb line, you know, and you look at it and you say, Shakespeare never would have allowed himself to say that, and then you quit writing for that morning. Write the first page. Tell yourself that. I mean, okay, the good stuff doesn't going to come for the, you know, for a page. And so let's start. And then do this kind of writing, and pretty soon, wham. The more you do it, you know, that it's closer and closer and closer to the first word you put down on the page. Is when this coherence, I don't even know how to talk about it. It's, your mind becomes coherent about a certain thing, and away you go.
It's funny for me, a lot of times it's more, it depends on the person, but a lot of, I find, I don't know if it's that I write this way so much, it's just having to get it down as quick as I can. You know, there's certain times you plot with each word and you deal with that, but for me, I feel like my head starts thinking that way so much of the time when I'm by myself.
Which way?
Well, I always like to have a pen with me because it's just thinking in terms of, you know, I'm reciting poems to myself, creating poems in my head or speaking them out loud or something, you know. And sometimes I get really annoyed because I catch something good and I don't remember to record it. But usually to me it's a phrase that I'll hear, you know, or I'll think of a word or a line, and usually I'll run as quick as I can to find a pen and put the line down. And then it comes, you know, and it's a lot of times for me, it's the in-between things, you know, because I get so carried away with and then. That a lot of times I think my first and my last stanzas are good, and the rest of it's gobbled.
Yeah,
you know?
Might be.
It just depends. Yeah.
It might be. I know that sometimes you can say the middle of a poem can be editorializing.
Yeah.
You'll gab the poem right away, maybe. Some poems do come, boom, real quick. Mm-hmm. And then you'll say, oof, that's really good, and then you try to explain it. And so you're writing an editorial on your own poem, and it's still in lines like poetry, but really, it's not necessary. Yeah. It doesn't trust the reader much. And so you can toss that sometimes. He says on this next page, this, okay, skills. And that this is so fun. Oh, it makes you tap your feet. You know, especially when you know that he has a lot of these things. He could say, oh, no, it takes, you know, all these things. See, he does have them. He's testifying against his own apparent bias because he is a National Book Award winning poet, and he could insist, you know, keep people from writing, you know, by intimidating them, but he won't do that. He says, he does give us some hints, though, wide reading, automatic orthodoxies in terms of, I suppose, lines, four-beat lines, certain things that you do and don't do, he's learned. Maneuvers of various kinds, he knows how to deal with certain poetic devices, which I think all of that comes from wide reading and criticizing other people's poems, not in a negative way, but positive criticism. What works? Why does that line work so well? And then finding out. But you learn those, but he says that skill doesn't have too much to do with that precious little area of confusion. The precious little area of confusion. And then he says, of course, it's a skill we all have at 3 or 4 to write. The writer is one who has become accustomed to trusting that grace or luck or skill and keeps at it. And keeps at it. The poets are seen by the ones that are writing poetry 40 years later. You know? The ones who've ended up. You don't have to... He stresses so much that this great, what's his line again? The great human activity of writing? You can find it.
Great free human activity. One of the great free human activities. Number 2.
Yeah, writing is itself. This kind of writing is one of the great free human activities. And everyone, you know, and he's really implying everyone should be doing this. Because everyone should be freer, shouldn't they? Mm-hmm. And everyone should be in about discovery and so forth. And then one of the things that I like so much about this, it frees me from thinking of myself self-consciously as a poet when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. I'm writing. It might be a poem. It might not be. It might be an essay. We'll see. Not going to worry about it. I'm not trying to. Writing, we can get confused. Sometimes we can be writing because we want to say we're writers. Or we write because we want to say we're poets or novelists or something like that. That's not a good reason to do it. You know, that messes us up. Then we try to sound like other novelists or poets we know. And I've gone through that situation where, you know, I try to sound poetic. Has anyone in here been involved in that? Later in workshop, I'll read 2 versions of the same poem, one which I was trying to sound poetic and the other one which I hesitated greatly to even hand in. I thought it was so unpoetic. And the one that I thought was unpoetic was so far and away better than this obscure bunch of busted syntax that I had on the other side of it. And it was just a mess. It was just I was trying to be a modern poet in one, and then I was me and John Graber writing a poem about something that meant a lot to me on the other one. And it was much longer. There was a great irony involved in that too, because I didn't write much in stanzas, and that the one that I just sat down and I tried and tried to write the poem. And then I wrote it like this modern, and I wasn't satisfied, and I just put it away, and I walked off. And then 2 days later, I put away all versions of the poem that I had written, you know, all 10 of them. And I sat down and I wrote it again. And that sucker, not even trying almost, a little bit of trying, that came out in 12 4-line stanzas. Mm. And they were perfect, and I didn't consciously write those 4 lines, you know. It's just the way it worked. Mm. It just happened. You know what? I don't know. It's neat.
A gift.
Yeah, a gift. Yeah. And this gives you a good attitude toward writing, too. Gift. Mm-hmm. It's not something...
Yeah. what you said about everybody, you know, listening to people, and it's giving everybody respect, given what he's saying, that it's, they're exercising the humility, you know, out of the difficulty that you can pick up. And it's like, this would be also exercising humility, because you can't, you're not taking credit in a certain sense for what's happening, allowing it to happen through you. And because of how you live, maybe, and there are outside reference points for what happens, but it's not that evil moment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's usually associated with a creative, you know, I am the creator.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think that's really good, and that this kind of writing frees, and there's a, what was the phrase you used? A study in humility, or what was it?
An
exercise in humility.
Yeah.
There are a few connections to be made there, too, between freedom and humility, I think. Because it certainly does, and he says, just, it's not negotiable. Much of what I say is not going to amount to much, and that's always refreshing for me to accept that as a writer. You know, and it freed many, many poems to know that most of what I would write would not amount to much. That freed me a great deal. I could start. I didn't have these impossible expectations for myself. Most isn't negotiable. It's like practice. You know, in writing, I launch many expendable efforts, just like in talking. Poor lifestyle students know how I talk like this. The way I teach, launching many expendable efforts, you know. That's why I have to insist for them to listen to a single phrase that they want to remember. This is the way I talk. What does he mean by, and sometimes it produces something that... can appear to be worthy. What does he mean by that? To appear to be worthy. What does he mean by worthy there?
Giving it to someone else to read a, you know, mm-hmm. poem or a sort of finished thing.
Mm-hmm. What would some of the other qualities be then of worthy that he's saying here? I don't even know.
Meaningful?
I like this negotiable better because,
true? Understandable.
Understandable, public language kind of thing. Something that can bear scrutiny, maybe, that you can look at again and again. It's like that sense of Yeats, this crazy Auden poem on Yeats. It never gets smaller than the first time you read it. It never gets smaller. It always changes. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think if anyone who's written knows that some of their things get bigger and bigger and bigger, even when you read them, and other ones get smaller and smaller. And pretty soon, they're just not interesting to you at all. One of the, I think the word, I don't like the word worthy here, but some things that you do will have that quality. I talk of it, it bears scrutiny. The closer you look at it, the better it gets. The more reasons you can give, the more meaning that you get out of it, the more joy you get out of just the sounds and so forth. And that's what I like to think of there. It's that the more you look at it, the better it gets, is the quality that he has. And 80% of the stuff that the person does, the more you look at it, the worse it gets. You know, I won't say the worse. I don't even, you know, I'll try to stay away from those kind of value things, judgment things. There's a time to make value judgments, and I don't think now is the time. Maybe when everybody's dead, let somebody else do that. But
there was something I was thinking of when you were talking about worthy, was something we said once in one of our sessions about the more I look into someone else's experience, the more I see my own in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in many, that's good. The sense of it appears to be worthy or successful. The poems that are going to be most worthy in terms of other people grasping them are the irony is that those will be the poems that I have gone deepest into myself. See? That the poems that are actually more have a greater private weight and have been put in public language, you know. The more personal I get, but in public language, the more I'll be telling. Well, it's like the more I tell my story, I will be telling yours. If I tell my story less, well, you're not going to know so much what I'm saying. You know, it's a crazy sort of paradox that if you dive into the particular deep enough, you come up with universals. Universal thing. That's what I think. One of the things that Blake meant when he saw how does it go, Elise? I saw the universe in a grain of sand, and eternity in an hour. These two points then that he brings up, the final two things for this one. Writers may not be special, sensitive, or talented. Now this is something, it's a gain and it's a loss, isn't it, this writing thing? Mm-hmm. You get some gain in terms of writing, but you also get some loss, because they also say, everybody should do this, and this, and then writers may not be special, sensitive, or talented in any usual sense. So it builds us up and brings us low at the same time. We're doing something in a sustained way. We're engaged in sustained use of language, a skill that we all have, confident reliance on stray impulses, the courage of imperfection, and we just keep doing it and doing it. And the difference is in that how much we do it, I guess. And the second, the great free human activity, and then he sounds like he's almost preaching, following with trust and forgiveness, that which occurs to him. Always, the person, the world, always remains ready and deep, an inexhaustible environment. This kind of writing helps keep alive a passion for life and a passionate worldview. We work back and forth between experience and thought. We're not locked into our chronological time. We have more than space and time can offer. We have the whole unexplored realm of human vision. The implication there is go and explore what you've already seen. You know, explore again what you've seen. Meet your experience. Come to terms with it. Insofar as you come to terms with it, you're doing a highly moral thing. You're doing James's moral imperative, is to come to terms with our experience. If you want to go that far, then you become all of a sudden, there's a moral element to this too.